on 1116 SEN. Welcome to the First Serve. Talking tennis for AFT Hire. For all your temporary fencing and portable toilet hire, call 1300 946 660 or log on to afthire.com.au.
Evening, everybody. 8 minutes after 11. Welcome along to the First Serve. And yes, thank you to our good friends at AFT Hire. They will look after you, Sash and Graham. Great SEN listeners. And we're not too far away from the greatest tennis tournament that there is. And there's only one man who can speak all about it.
My first win here in 2003, I had a win here as a junior, I beat Sampras here in 2001, and then, you know, the rest is history, and I've had so much success here, and it's a tournament I love most. You know, I love coming here. It's such an honour to be a member of the club, and I hope I can do it.
The great Roger Federer, he's won Wimbledon 7 times, so has Pete Sampras, so has William Renshaw, and Martina Navratilova, of course, won 9 Wimbledon titles all those years ago. The championships, as it's affectionately known, Wimbledon, the oldest tennis tournament in the world, widely considered the most prestigious, and it has been held at the All England Club in Wimbledon, London, since 1877. The only major still played on the grass, the game's original surface, which gave the game its original name of lawn tennis. And the traditions include, of course, the strict dress code for competitors, the eating of strawberries and cream by the spectators, and of course, it wouldn't be Wimbledon without a bit of royal patronage. It is a special tournament. I've been lucky enough to go a couple of times, and certainly you want to go back. Brett Phillips, great to have you, Paul Aiken, alongside me, and we're not too far away from what is going to be a spectacular fortnight.
Good evening, BP, and to all the listeners out there, and what a day in tennis. A few little spot fires emerging.
What's going on?
On the eve of the big one. Yes. And, mate, listening to you and KB this morning, you went hard.
Well, there's a bit to discuss, and let's bring in Bojana Babusic, a good friend of ours, and she's going to be at Wimbledon. She takes off on Friday to head to SW19, former WTA professional, to discuss some of the hot topics in tennis. Bojana, welcome to you.
Thanks, guys. Nothing like a little bit of drama before a Grand Slam event.
Exactly. Let's start with the Sarah Tomic, Bernard Tomic situation. And I think one of the questions we want to tell our SEN audience tonight, who mightn't all be right across the inner workings of tennis, is the funding situation for players, Bojana. You've been a player who's been in the system, who has been funded at various times. Now, the issue here is that John Tomic has taken his daughter away from the Tennis Australia program in the last 6 to 12 months to coach her himself, but now is crying out wanting funding. Can you explain to our listeners tonight the funding system and how it works for young players?
Yeah, well, Tennis Australia obviously have a criteria, and that criteria is based upon tracking top 100 players from when they first started playing on the tour. And so they've tracked them every year, and they've sort of set a benchmark of where these top 100 players are based on about 12 to 15 years of tracking. And that's how Tennis Australia has based their criteria. Now, there's 3 types of funding available for athletes. The first one is a full scholarship. So you get a one-on-one coach, tours, domestic and international, paid for, training facility, psychology, physio, anything that you could possibly need as an athlete is provided based upon you meeting that full scholarship criteria. Now, for Sarah Tomic, for example, there's a ranking criteria that she would have to meet to get that funding. Yep. And for her age group, so she's 17, born in 1998. So the criteria that she has to meet is either a top 10 junior ITF ranking or be within the top 480 WTA, so the Women's Professional Tour.
Okay, and right now she's at 765 and she's ranked 49 in the juniors.
Yep, she is. And going back about, probably about September 2013, when she would have been about 15 at that stage, she met the criteria. So she got on a full scholarship, she had a one-on-one coach, she had everything paid for. And then up until about September last year, so that would have been her 12-month contract, the Tomics decided, no, we want to do our own thing, don't want to work with that one-on-one coach that was provided. My understanding is they went to Turkey, They were working with whoever they wanted to, and they've been doing it their own way. So I find John's sort of contradicting himself because, you know, Tennis Australia provided Sarah Tomic with all the funding. She met the criteria. They took it on. She had the coaching. She had everything paid for. Then they decided, nope, we don't want it anymore. We want to do our own thing. So I'm not, question marks as to not understanding why he's made those sort of comments.
Hi, Bodge. How are you going?
Good, thanks, Paul.
Yeah, look, although having said that at the moment, but playing the devil's advocate, there's probably no other girls that are doing the same, setting the world on fire either.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other ways of meeting or getting some funding is, so you've either got the full scholarship, you've got a wild card status, so athletes can be brought into the National Academy at the discretion of the national head coach. So that could be based on their attitude, some results, but maybe not the ranking points. So there's that option. And then there's also something called the 90-10. So 10% of athletes don't necessarily want to associate themselves with the national program. However, if they meet the criteria, they can get funding. But a lot of that depends upon, you know, some athletes live overseas, can't have those coaches. So sure, Tennis Australia will, support that 10% of athletes. But look, it's based upon criteria. So you'll find it's actually very hard to meet for someone, with Sarah's age or a lot of the other junior girls. Not a lot of them are on a full scholarship, but that's based upon historical data. So they're trying to track athletes that will make that top 100 and set criteria. So you can't really argue with the research that's been done. And so if you want to aim to be Maria Sharapova or Serena Williams or Radwanska, I mean, that's where they were at when they made that, that transition.
Well, this seems quite odd to me, Bayana, because if you read the quotes from John Tomic today, so he's taken his daughter out of this program.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you just put all the facts on the table of what she was being granted across that 12-month period.
Yeah, and he's allowed to do that. He's allowed to take her out of the program if
correct.
He doesn't see that it suits her or if she,
yep.
he doesn't think she's developing. So it's not, I think that's not the topic about them leaving the program. It's probably more, okay, well, now he's saying, we haven't gotten any funding, I'm not getting any funding. Yes, I think that's the controversial thing, yeah.
And the bit that's the extension is that he is saying to Bernard Tomic, well, you're not playing Davis Cup, but I think you can also tell us tonight there could be some repercussions there if he doesn't actually represent Australia in July.
Yeah, it's sort of like the whole Tomic saga going a few years back, and we haven't really heard much of John Tomic for a while, and it just seemed like Bernie was getting back on track. He's had some really good results. He's at a career high ranking. And then for John to turn around, John to say that, look, Bernie's not going to play Davis Cup and he's going to go to Newport is, I don't know. I don't know where, I think there has to come a line where Bernie sort of steps up and says, you know what, I'm going to play Davis Cup for Australia. You know, we've got a good opportunity of making the semi-finals. We could potentially win it with the guys we have in the team. I just don't think he's doing himself any favours. Oh, yeah, I don't understand that either. Baffled.
Look, another theory of mine, Bodge, is that the funding may well be just a red herring and it could be all to do with something else, perhaps, that we're not privy to a personality clash. But who would know, when John's around, there always seems to be drama following him.
Yeah, my understanding is that John actually wants to coach Sarah. But what does he want that funding for? Because, does he want it for travel? Does he want it for tournaments? Does he want it for physio? So really, he's gone out and said, we get no funding. We don't have any money. But, okay, well, tell us, what do you want the funding for? Is it coaching? Is it? So it's pretty vague. And to make those sort of accusations based upon the fact that she was funded for a full year, I think there's a bit more explaining to do there.
All right. I reckon this will probably get sorted. I think wise voices, Australia can't be in a situation where they haven't got Bernard Tomic playing against Kazakhstan in July.
On grass.
Exactly on right. Grass. He's our number one pick in the singles now that Leighton's bowing out and Kyrgios and Kokkinakis are still that little smidge behind in terms of experience on the global tour. So hopefully it does get sorted out. I reckon this will probably smooth over. We've got a few topics to cover. Let's get on to Nick Kyrgios. Paul, I want to get your take first on what you make of the situation with Todd Larkin. Knowing a bit about Todd as a former professional player and the man who's mentored Nick for a large part of his tennis career.
You go, Paul.
Look,
reading between the lines, and this is why you get me in here, BP, to do that. look, I'd have to say where there's smoke, there's fire, and there could be a suggestion out there that Nick perhaps is hard to motivate, but knowing his coach is a player and he was one of the most dedicated, hardest working players, perhaps he and Nick could have had a clash in philosophies. But having said that, we really don't know that. And there's not a coach out there that doesn't have a blue with the player. And it's a hard gig.
Well, give us your take, Bayana, and both of you can discuss this. I mean, I was making mention on SEN earlier today, and I can only think of, you know, Uncle Tony and Rafa, who have been together for his entire career. Other than that, every player that I can think of has had multiple coaches across their journey. So it's, I imagine when you're in each other's pockets, travelling the globe, staying at hotels, living and breathing it, those relationships can certainly go pear-shaped, or you just need a freshen up at some point.
Well, I mean, since last year when Nick parted ways with Simon Ray, he obviously went back to Todd, who, you know, they're both from Canberra. They had that existing relationship. So I thought that was a perfect fit. Nick did great, you know, did well at the Australian Open, had a really good clay court season. And so sometimes when players switch coaches, it's based on performance and results. But I can't really seem to relate that between Nick and Todd Larkin. So it's just another sort of thing I'm not quite understanding. But look, I remember Sam Stosur split last year with her coach, Miles McLennan, around just less than a week before Wimbledon as well. So it must be something where players feel that it's something that they have to do there and then to take care of it. Otherwise, it's going to play on their minds. But I mean, sure, as a player and when you have your coach on tour, you're on the court together all the time. But, you know, there's the rest of the day to sort of not be together. So I don't know if it's, if they spent too much time together or, you know, if there was a bit of a clash there. I wouldn't say that Nick would be the easiest person to work with.
No.
But if anyone knew how to deal with him, it would be Todd because he knew him
You'd
from such a
so.
Young age. Mm. So it'll be hard now to think about, all right, well, who's going to coach Nick now? Because, like I said, I thought Todd, because he knew him, he knew his personality as a junior. Now it's a big question mark as to who will step up and take that on board.
Well, listening to some of his comments on social media last night didn't fill me with a lot of confidence. After he lost to Wawrinka, who, let's face it, is just a gun, he said, oh, look, I'm going to go batten down the hatches. I'm going to be inside my apartment, shut out all the media. I thought that was a bit negative and a bit reactive.
Yeah, I'm trying to get a read on this. I mean, we compare, so, you know, there's always been some controversy attached to the Tomic camp. And a lot of people will tell you that Bernie's a terrific kid and he loves being part of the Davis Cup setup and, you know, Leighton has taken him under his belt to a degree. Tony Roach has tried to take him under his wing and mentor him. Then we've got the Kyrgios situation where drama seems to unfold. We don't hear any of this really coming out of the Kokkinakis camp, and we've talked about his temperament, Paul, and Bayana as well, on court, and he seems like he's a really level-headed young guy. Off court is getting some really good advice. So these three we're going to keep comparing as they're all similarly ranked and following a journey over the next 3 or 4 years. And right now you'd say Kokkinakis seems to just have everything going quite smoothly.
Yeah, well, a lot of it comes down to not just how you hit tennis balls on a court, but for me, if I draw back from my own experience, it was having, you know, a consistent support group who I knew I could rely on, knew my go-to people. But if those people are chopping and changing and you're reacting to a bad result on a consistent basis, I can't see that really helping a player. But then again, I mean, Nick's proven that he can play on any surface, he can beat anybody on any given day. So maybe they're just completely different athletes, completely different personalities, and they sort of thrive on different scenarios. And maybe for Nick, he does like that drama and he does sort of like creating a story that sort of gets him going. I don't know. I think it would just be a matter of let's just sit and wait and see how the next year pans out, the next 2 years, and see where they go from there.
Guys, let's take a quick look back before I let you go, Bayona. Just on last weekend, we had Roger Federer, who owns the tournament in Halle in Germany. His eighth victory in this tournament. Yeah. It just seems that if there's no Djokovic, Nadal or Murray and Federer's the top seed, he's going to win the vast majority of these tournaments at the 500, 250 level that he plays in. He defeated Andreas Seppi. Had that great win back at the Australian Open, the only time he's ever beaten
great
Federer.
Win.
12-1 head-to-head. We had Andy Murray winning Queens. He's won that for a fourth time. He looks to be in really good nick. And, of course, on the girls' side of the tour, Angelique Kerber played an unbelievable match. I think went over 2 hours to defeat Karolina Pliskova, who hit a stack of winners, but Kerber made very few unforced errors. I might get you both just to talk about those three results from the weekend. Paul, a word on the men, Roger and Andy?
Well, he just must step onto that court at Halle and think, I own this court. I mean, he's won it eight times. Are they going to name the stadium after him?
Almost.
People were saying that they should.
Yeah. He survived, I saw a bit of that match, he survived two set points at 15-44, five down, produced two massive aces, just completely changed the momentum of the match and then, of course, went on to win. And, Bodge, you could probably tell us about Pliskova because I'm very impressed with her serve.
Yeah, well, I actually watched her a little bit last week playing against Kerber and against Mladenovic, and gee, she really suits the grass court. Quite a tall, lean girl, can rely on her first serve, but also her ability when she's pushed out wide just to smack a ball down the line that's not returnable. She was just in really good form and has a really, you know, like not a, just a calm sort of temperament where nothing seemed overwhelming. She looked comfortable being in the semis, being in the final. I actually thought maybe she would have overcome Kerber, but, I mean, Kerber's a great competitor. But,
good fighter, yep.
Yeah, really good fighter. But I think Pliskova will be, I think she'll go deep through Wimbledon. I see her game suiting the grass courts really well. She beat Casey in a tight one last night, 6-4, 7-5, and she's currently playing Radwanska out in Eastbourne. But just a couple of names that stand out. It's great to see Dominika Sibulkova back from injury. I know she had foot surgery.
Yep.
So it's great to see her back. Sloane Stephens, I think, is sort of finding some good form. She beat Carla Suarez Navarro last night comfortably. And Dara Gavrilova lost in qualies but got a lucky loser spot because Petra Kvitova pulled out from an illness.
Yeah, she plays a little bit later on, takes on Irani. And interestingly, Bod, she defeated Laura Robson, a girl we've almost forgotten about, who was, well, once in her own backyard here in Melbourne and went to live and migrated to the UK. 6-love, 6-1. She won that Gavrilova. And, of course, she's coming back, Robson, from wrist surgery, which we know has plagued Juan Martín del Potro, which is a tough injury to come back from.
Absolutely.
So she'll get better, but Gavrilova gets a second chance and going on her form this year, guys. She tends to make the most of it.
She does, and she beat Camilla Giorgi, who you know, won a grass court event about 2 weeks ago out in her, I never know how to say this, but her,
in the Netherlands.
In the Netherlands, we'll just say in the Netherlands. But, you know, I think she's got a great opportunity of beating Irani, you know, particularly because Irani's a clay court player. But, no, great to see Dara back out there. And I thought it was interesting to see whether Wimbledon will give Laura Robson a main draw wild card, whether it would be better for her to play qualifying. But, in terms of form and matches, you'd think that maybe qualifying would have been better for it. But anyways.
Bodge, just before you go, Eugenie Bouchard, too, beating Alison Risk last night, looked pretty good. Mm-hmm. What do you think of her chances? Well, and she plays Bencic,
she
I
did,
see.
Yeah, and she's had to retire. Yeah, it just happened a few moments ago, actually.
Yeah.
And she was struggling.
Down.
Yeah, absolutely. And she's had to retire, Bouchard, so she can't take a trick.
That would have been a great match because Bencic
is... She's got a final to defend at Wimbledon. So she's got a lot of points to defend. Big question marks around her as well. But let's hope. I mean, she's a top 10 player. There's no doubt about it. But she's seriously struggling with some confidence right now.
Absolutely. We'll let you go. You're going across to SW19. So we're going to talk to you at Wimbledon over the next fortnight. You're doing some work and people can listen to the live radio call. Tell us what you're doing over the next fortnight.
Yes, I'm just commentating radio for Live at Wimbledon. So it's just from the Wimbledon app, there's a little tab there which is Live at Wimbledon. So be doing a bunch of radio, hopefully a couple of other things, but I'll suss that out when I get there. But no, just looking forward to getting amongst it, watching the players on the grass, sort of envious of them right now. But no, it'll be great.
And we're envious of you going over there.
Exactly. Yeah. Suitcase packed for next year, I tell you.
Yeah, I haven't been back since I played juniors, which is a long time ago, so it'll be a blast from the past.
Oh, they'll open up the pearly gates for you, don't worry about that.
Cry me a river.
Good luck, Bodge. We'll talk next week.
Sounds good. Have a good night.
Safe flight. Bernard Bobusic joining us, as she always does. And the other good news from last weekend as we head to the break, Maddie Ebden, back-to-back finals, runner-up this time to Dennis Kudler in that Challenger up there in Yorkshire. It's amazing you get 35 points if you win a Challenger. Only went up the 6 spots if you runner up. There's the fine margin of guys who are trying to break through to get to the top 100. You've got to win them.
Yeah.
Got to win them.
Well done on a wild card for him, though.
Yep.
As you said, you know, he's come a long way in a few months ago, losing twice in successive weeks to young Omar Jasika. You know, but I'm told from players that his confidence is sky high and he's well suited to grass. The other one who got a wild card, who was a former player here, Bryden Klein.
Yes.
Got one and was our very best junior here, some 5-7 years ago.
But yeah, he was.
His game never really improved, I didn't think, after that.
A couple of dummy spits.
He's
gone foul of the administration, unfortunately. But I saw him down in Traralgon when I went to that Challenger late last year. And, yeah, it's tough when you don't quite get there. You've got to battle away in the 200s, the 300s. And anyway, that's life on the other side of the tour.
You're not, mate.
Roger Federer and co. We'll take a break. After the break, Paul, we're going to chat to a man who won Wimbledon.
Yeah, look.
In the doubles. A great story. We'll tell you more about it after the break. Stephen Huss, and he's now a coach of a couple of girls who are in the women's doubles. He's out on the practice courts as we speak over there in the UK, and we'll talk to him next here on the First Serve. Welcome back to the First Serve. It's 28 to midnight. Paul Aitken is with me, Brett Phillips, on this side of the desk. We're not too far away from the championships, as they're affectionately known, at SW19. It is where tradition reigns in the world of tennis. And we're going to have plenty of Australians. And we've got, in fact, Quali's going. And we'll get to that a little bit later on in the hour, because we've got a number of the men, Paul, who are still alive in qualifying.
Very exciting.
Anastasia Rodionova, and we'll get onto that a little bit later on. And also Olivia Rogoska bowed out last night of the Qualies and the Women's. But a lot of the boys haven't played yet tonight, so we'll keep an eye on those results. But a girl who normally sits in your chair does a great job. One of our co-hosts here on the First Serve. But
we
at this time
her.
Of the year, she just jets off overseas, and she's right in the thick of it, and she's always
she's got a better offer.
Got a very big role just looking after the Assembled Media and co. A beautiful Eastbourne traditional lead up tournament to the great Wimbledon Championships. Charlotte James on deck. Good afternoon to you, CJ.
Hi, Charlotte.
Hello, how are you?
Nice to speak to you. How's it all operating at Eastbourne? It's a good field you've got. I know Kvitova had to pull out, unfortunately, but it's a beautiful setting, and I imagine everything's going beautifully.
Going swimmingly. It's a gorgeous day here today. Beautiful blue sky, not too much breeze. It can be a bit windy down here. Just glorious and very exciting because the British girls here are having some really good results this week. So we just had a mammoth, probably the biggest cheer ever from centre court for Johanna Konta, who just beat Margarita, number 14 seed here. So she's actually through to the quarterfinals, which is very exciting.
That is a good story. Used to be under the Australian banner, didn't she, Konta?
Yeah. I think she was born over here, but she trained in Spain for a fair while. And she moved over here, I think, when she was about 7 or something like that. So she's been over here for a long time with her family. And, makes her home actually here at Eastbourne. So everybody's going a bit bananas, as you can imagine.
Hi, Charlotte. Could you tell us a bit about what happened with Eugenie Bouchard and Belinda Bencic?
Yeah, so she had a hip strain, Bouchard. She was down 3-6, love 3, I think, on centre court's first match today and pulled out of that match against Bencic with a strain. Came into press. She seemed in reasonably good form. She obviously won, you know, the first round match here that she's won for a fair while on the tour. So she's not been in bad form this week. Obviously disappointed to pull out, but you'd imagine that she's kind of nursing it to make sure that something more serious doesn't develop for Wimbledon, I think.
Yeah, tough year for her. The Australian girls in this tournament, we know that Jamila Gajdosova got knocked out by Wozniacki. Pliskova, who's having obviously a very good year, and behind Petra Kvitova, the number two Czech player, knocked out Casey Delacroix. Poronkova, who, well, she has fired at this time of the year. In fact, knocked over Dominika Sibulkova today after knocking out Sam Stosur yesterday. Been a previous semi-finalist at Wimbledon, CJ. So she's one of those players that is fairly erratic but can pop up and have some really good results.
Yeah, she quite likes it here, I think. She likes the surface, and she's having another good week. So it's interesting to see how she's progressing, really, because she's one of those stealth players that you don't necessarily look for in a draw, but, you know, just wangles away around.
Yeah, she certainly does. And one I just want to ask you about is Belinda Bencic, because there's a lot of talk about
she's been emerging.
This young girl who's taken enormous strides and has been in seedings at 32. I mean, you're watching her up close, Charlotte. You've observed her for a little while. I mean, is she a girl that is capable, do you think, of going the next step? And, I mean, she's still so young, so a lot of time left to develop her career, but obviously developing at a rapid rate.
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. I think everybody here who's in the know thinks that she's a definite, you know, prospect for the top 10 and possibly even beyond that. You know, she's, again, developing very well. She's doing well on a lot of different surfaces. She's a good all-rounder. And, yeah, she's just steadily improving. So I think very promising signs for her.
And one match here that I've cast my eye over, CJ, is Pliskova versus Radwanska. I'd say there'd be a little bit of variety in this match between how the two girls play.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's going to be a bit of a slicey, dicey affair. It'll be interesting because Radwanska, you know, always big expectations around her at this tournament. And she's rare, I think she's won it once, but, you know, has often not lived up to those expectations.
Mm.
Comes here, you know, with the lowest ranking that she's had for quite some time. She really is under the radar. But, you know, you'd think with her game that she should do very well on the grass. So it'll be interesting. And, you know, obviously she's the number 9 seed here. Pliskova is the number 8 seed. So they couldn't be more closely matched, probably.
That is true. And we were just mentioning before the re-emergence of Laura Robson. Pretty tough comeback. Went down to Daria Gavrilova, first round qualies, 6-love, 6-1. But she's had that wrist injury, which has kept her out off the tour for about 18 months. And we've seen what it's done. It's debilitated Juan Martín del Potro for the last 3 or 4 years. So tough one to come back and play. But what was her sort of frame of mind? And, I mean, just having her back on the tour, what was that like this week?
For Robson, you know, she was very philosophical about that match and, you know, very, very happy to just be back playing a match, basically, you know, be back on court. She knows that she's got an awful lot of work to do. Just, you know, she was very good in her press conference, very humorous about it, you know, made a bit of a joke about talking to her coach, and he said, that's great. You know, you've taken the first step. You know, you're back playing, that's great. You've only got to do one other thing now. And she said, okay, what's that? And he said, everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, she gets it. And I think, you know, you need to mention Gavrilova as well. She played an amazing match last night, came back, you know, 1 in 3 sets, went till about 8:30 at night. So that didn't impress me, obviously, because
she's tenacious.
I like to try and get the food here in East Wales very good, I have to say. So, delayed dinner a bit, but she's on court against Irani today on court 1, the number 13 seed, and I'd say she's got a real chance.
It's hard not to like her. I mean, she's just a girl who goes out and plays every match like it's her last. I mean, that's what we love watching about elite sports people. CJ, enjoy Eastbourne. You'll be off to Wimbledon for a fortnight, which you've been going to for a number of years. Always a spectacular fortnight. Hopefully a little bit of Australian success, and the Brits, I'm sure, will make some noise as well.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting.
Good on you.
Thanks, CJ.
Enjoy. Talk soon. Charlotte James. She'll wander back into the studios here at some point in the near future. Hey, qualies going on at the moment. As I mentioned, the boys are coming a little bit later on, but overnight, I don't know if you saw
this. We'd be doing cartwheels over this. You got
just before the break,
mm-hmm.
Anastasia Rodionova last night. Now, look, I've had my own personal run-in with Anastasia. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say she's the easiest person to get along with, to be totally honest. Got knocked out first round overnight. Look, I haven't seen this girl play, but Anne-Sophie Mustak of Belgium. It went 3 sets.
Now, during the match, this is quite typical. Anyone that's watched Anastasia's matches, muttering, complaining, had an injury timeout in the second set.
Yeah, we've seen a bit of that.
6-3-2 love down.
Right.
She then started directing her histrionics towards the chair umpire. She said, quote, "How can you not overrule that ball? It is this much out. You ought to be ashamed. Are you normal?"
Oh, no.
She then got a warning.
She went down that path.
Her opponent won the match. She let out a big scream and then a very, very ordinary handshake at the end. And I went back and I watched the video. And I was at Wimbledon this year when she played Svetlana Kuznetsova, 2010, and Kuznetsova would not shake her hand after the match. I mean, she's known on the tour for being...
Yeah.
I don't know. Can I say it this time of the night? Probably about 11:41. A bitch, basically. I'll say it.
Well, there you go.
No one can back away from that.
No.
The way she carries on court is an absolute disgrace.
Yep.
Absolute disgrace.
Yep, fair enough.
And this is history repeating itself over and over again, and she's not in the second round of qualies. We're going to take a break. Stephen Huss, we've been promising him. He's coming up next. Keep
great
your powder
man.
Dry. Quarter to 12, we're right through till midnight and then the all-night appetite to take you through the very early hours. We chatted to Charlotte James at Eastbourne. The men are playing at Nottingham. Sam Groth was the only Aussie in that tournament. Got knocked out by Souza last night. The 14th seed, Marcos Baghdatis, having a great run. He knocked out David Ferrer and has won through to the quarterfinals only a couple of hours ago. So he is the draw card there at Nottingham. We've got Aussie boys coming up in the qualies a little bit later on. Jason Kubler, JP Smith, John Millman, Luke Saville, and also Benny Mitchell in the early hours of the morning. So fingers crossed, Paul, they can get through to the final round of qualifying.
Look, that is so exciting. And, you know, with what have we got there? One, two, three, four, five guys.
Yep.
I mean, I would never have said this, mate, but the depth is now starting to rival France or Spain, which I would never have said.
Well, let's hope that a few can certainly keep progressing. One man's holding on because he, 10 years ago, saluted at the championships. Along with his partner, Wesley Murdy, he became the first qualifier to win the Wimbledon Men's Doubles Championship back in 2005, beating the 6th seed, the 9th, the 3rd, the 1st and the 2nd seeds, if you don't mind, in the process. His Wimbledon title was only his second doubles title on the ATP Tour after his 2002 success at Casablanca with a fellow by the name of Miles Wakefield. I speak of Stephen Huss, and you know a little bit about Stephen before we welcome him on the line.
Look, this guy is just amazing. Many people locally had a real connection with him. It certainly really echoed down to all the grassroots. He coached incidentally by a good friend of mine, an outstanding Australian coach, Peter Lumsden.
Yep.
It was just so surreal when he won this tournament, and he's just one of the best net players and double strategists in the world.
Indeed. He probably won't remember, but he did special comments with us on SCN at one of the Australian Opens a few years ago, and it's great to welcome Stephen Huss from the practice courts over there at Wimbledon. Stephen, welcome.
Hussie.
Hey, fellas, how you doing? Good to be with you.
Great to speak to you. Before we look back, you're coaching, you're looking after a couple of girls who have just been through a practice session?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm coaching Abigail Spears and Raquel Cops-Jones. They're a doubles team from America, and they'll probably be seated somewhere around 6, 7, or 8 here. So they're going along beautifully. We're doing a practice week here before Wimbledon. They played 2 lead-up events and won one of them, which was great, and then we're here with a lot of the, you know, kind of a lot of the higher rank guys and the seeds are playing and practicing here this week while, you know, a lot of the other players are at Eastbourne or Nottingham preparing. So it feels good to be here with, actually today we kicked off Aixi's old hitting partner, Stefan Edberg and Federer and Hewitt.
See, it wasn't a lie.
We went on the court after then, so yeah. Remember that, Aixi? Didn't you hit with him one time?
Mate, that was the greatest day of my life, and my wife was there. She can verify this story. But anyway, I won't go into that. It's all about you today. But yeah, that was a magic moment. Mate, how does it feel to return to Wimbledon as a coach?
Yeah, it feels good, mate. I mean, this place is amazing. I mean, this is the mecca of tennis. I mean, I absolutely love the Australian Open, and I think it's an unbelievable event. But even growing up in Australia, I think that Wimbledon has that mystique. And, you know, just returning here, just walking through the gates is just awesome. It's the pinnacle of tennis, and I love coming back. And, yeah, sure, it'll be fun to be still playing, but I'm very fortunate that I played here a lot of times and got to play, and now I'm happy to be back coaching. So
take us back 10 years ago, the memory of winning the Wimbledon final, beating the Bryan brothers, and obviously they've gone on to have an outstanding career. What are your memories of what you and Wes Moody did 10 years ago?
Well, we don't have enough time if you want everything, because I do remember everything. I mean, when you only have really one big result in your whole career, you got to remember it. I remember coming through qualifying. I remember it was unbelievably windy in qualifying, and I thought, I'm playing with Moody. He's got a massive serve. If I can hold my serve, we're going to be in every match. And so I practiced every day. I practiced serving downwind, second serves. I mean, it was really, really windy. So that's what I remember from qualifying. And then from the main draw, I mean, beating Todd Woodbridge in the second round, you know, fellow Australia, and then the guy that's won here 9 times and was going for his 10th title, that was just enormous for me to beat him. And that really gave me the belief for the rest of the tournament that we were able to play with and beat anybody else. And, you know, like you pointed out earlier, we took out a bunch of seeds and a bunch of players that had been number one in the world. So it was just a dream run, and we were very much in the zone, and I had the same routine and night to night, and really didn't think about the points I was making or the money I was making, and you know, there was no emphasis on that. It was just about the game plan. I would email Peter Lumsden, my coach back in Australia, the game plan, how I was going to attack him and what we were going to do. And I was just in a really set routine and just, you know, really confident. And I'm not usually like that, but, you know, sometimes it happens that you get in that zone, and that's where we were. And even at those moments in matches where you kind of realise where you are, I had a moment in the final when we were a break up in the fourth set that, you know, sort of said, hey, I kind of looked around the stadium and thought, you know what, we're going to win this thing. And immediately I got nervous, but I was able to kind of notice that and then just get back to playing doubles. And that's what I told myself. Hey, you're just playing doubles. Remember, it's just doubles, and you know how to play doubles. So, yeah, but it was obviously an awesome time and a huge highlight in my career.
I remember, mate, that campaign, you really played a lot of I formation.
Yep, that's true, yep.
And really put that on the map. But my next question to you is, what are you trying to instill in your players at Virginia Tech? And do they actually realise that you won Wimbledon 10 years ago?
You'd be telling them, wouldn't you?
They obviously know that I come from a playing background, and that's really good going in, because I think, you know, you get a lot of respect straight away.
Absolutely.
Which is handy. Not all coaches get that, I don't think, so it's nice to have that. But the two main things that I bring to the university that I've noticed when I first went there was the intensity in practice was a lot lower than it was on the Pro Tour when I was playing. So just the intensity of practice, trying to make that higher, trying to make every practice count and to really practice at a higher intensity. And then the other thing was, as I looked around all the other players and the college tennis in general, the mental part of it was pretty down, I thought. And I thought that was a real place where we could gain an advantage. So we work mentally with the guys a lot and try and make them mentally tough. Them do a lot of practice situations to try and test them and give them adversity. And so when they get in that competitive environment in the tough matches, and when they're the last person on and everyone's screaming, that they, you know, that they might be stronger than the guy at the other end. So they're the two main things that I've brought to the team as a whole. But, you know, I love doing the individual sessions with the guys as well, you know, working on their games and trying to get them a little bit better week by week, and then obviously get them to progress and give themselves a chance after college to go out and sort of have the dream that I had, which was to go out and play the Pro Tour when you're done with college.
That's awesome. What are some of the trends that you're seeing from college tennis now and in men's tennis in general?
I think these days you cannot get away with not being a good athlete. I mean, all the players are getting bigger, stronger, faster. And, you know, the guys that used to be the odd guy who was sort of 6'5" and would serve rockets, but he wouldn't really move that well. Well, now, you know, you see these guys who serve rockets and they're running around like gazelles as well, like a Del Potro, you know. So I think that there's better athletes in tennis now, and so you really have to be a good athlete. And then, unfortunately, the net games is kind of disappearing more and more. And, you know, that's got to do with the power, the movement, and then the strings, I think. I mean, the strings that they're using now just allow you to get the spin and so much power on your shot. So coming to the net is harder because the space has become a little bit better, a little bit bigger for the guy who's trying to pass you. I mean, gone are the days where you sort of slice the ball to the guy's backhand and come in. It's just not going to work anymore.
Well, that's what I was, my next question was leading to, is where you see doubles evolving to, because obviously we're seeing a lot more baseline exchanges, and be it that coaches now aren't, you know, coaching as much serve and volley, or even aren't even focusing on volley in practice sessions. I mean, how do you see that evolving?
Yeah, it really is trending towards, you know, more baseline play. And, you know, I think it's got to do with the surfaces are slowing down. I mean, I spoke to the people the generation before me, and they're like, you know, at Wimbledon you wouldn't even think about staying back because the courts were so fast and they were bumpy. And, you know, I've talked to Wayne Ferreira, and he's told me people would just laugh if you tried to stay back. You couldn't do it. But, you know, now the surfaces are so true and they're so good. So
like hard
people are staying back a lot more. But, I mean, you've still got guys at the top who can volley and do utilise the net some. I mean, I think that Federer has obviously done really well with that these last couple of years, coming in a bit more since he's had Edberg. And then Djokovic can come forward as well. And Rafa's actually a very, I think he's an underrated volleyer. He volleys pretty well. So I think it's still a, it's still a part of the game that needs to be utilised. I mean, Andy Murray is another guy. I was talking to Jonas Bjorkman yesterday, and he said he's trying to get him to come in a bit more and get to net and return early and come forward, even if it's, you know, once or twice a set, just to kind of have the guy off balance. So it's still a huge string in the bow to be able to come forward, but you don't want to be totally one-dimensional. So hopefully it won't, you know, disappear forever.
Stephen Huss, our special guest here on the First Serve, along with Wes Moody. They won Wimbledon back a decade ago in 2005, knocked over the Bryan brothers in one of the great tennis victories. Now, there's a guy on the SMS here, Stephen, Drewy in Greensboro, who says, I beat Stephen Huss in a junior tournament at Camberwell Tennis Courts 9-7 back in 1989. Can you verify that, Steve?
He's reaching.
I'm sure that's right, mate. One of the things about my career was that I lost to anybody and I could beat anybody. That was a bit what it was like. So I'm sure when I when we had that success in 2005, there were hundreds of people going around Melbourne going, I beat that guy, he's not very good.
And I think that's why it touched so many people that you won. I mean, it was just, I mean that in a nice way. It was just like someone here winning it. It kept the dream alive.
Yep, no doubt. Just one generic question I wanted to ask you, Stephen. I mean, you know, from the outside looking in, the tennis tour, and Paul's coached and been out and about on the tennis tour, and I'm looking in, you know, fascinated about the lifestyle of tennis players, the entourages, travelling with coaches, and we talked, you know, throughout the early part of the show about, you know, players and coaches regularly changing over. Are there more highs than lows, or are there more lows than highs, you know, being a professional tennis player? And I suppose, you know, Feliciano Lopez touched on it last week. You've got to get used to, you know, losing. It's going to happen every week. Take us just inside how you see the tour.
Honestly, unless you're, you know, one of the really top guys like a Nadal or a Federer or a Djokovic, and these guys that basically win, you know, three quarters of the time they play a tournament, you know, they're the exception, not the rule. And the rule is really, you know, you leave in a week a loser every week. And so, you know, I think Feliciano Lopez is right. I mean, it is hard, and I think there's more lows than there are highs. But it's just, it's so rewarding to practice, to work. And so when the highs do come around, they're so rewarding. But part of being a successful tennis player is not just being able to play tennis and you know, be good on the day. It's really about being resilient. It's about, you know, rolling with the losses. It's about, you know, traveling to the next tournament and taking a loss. I mean, I can't tell you how many times during my career I flew halfway around the world and then lost first round.
Yeah.
And, you know, to most people, that's just like, why would I fly 4,000 miles or whatever, however far, and then just lose a match? You know, why would I do that again? And so that's a huge part of the tour, is being resilient, is learning to deal with the losses, is just looking to the next week, giving yourself another opportunity. And I think if you don't ultimately love practicing, love competing, then you're not going to last very long. I mean, I think we see that through you know, I'm sure Aixey and everyone who's played has had juniors or friends that were much better than them when they were younger, and they thought that they would go on and play the tour. But it's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot more than just playing matches and winning or losing. It's a, you know, it's about organising and managing and being resilient and all that sort of stuff. So there is a big aspect to that.
It's a long journey.
Yep, no doubt about that. Stephen, great to catch up with you. All the best with the girls for the next fortnight. Maybe they can create the magic you did with Wes Moody a decade
legend,
ago.
And I believe he's a Geelong supporter.
Cats man.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, yeah, the Cats...
Who, me?
Isn't that you?
No.
That... Oh, I got that right.
I'm a Hawks, mate. I'm a Hawks supporter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. That was
I put on that Geelong jumper back in 2005 because my buddy Brad Seeney, who eight knows, he travelled all the way from LA to come watch me on the spur of the moment.
I got it wrong.
And he said, can you put this on? I said, no way. And he goes, come on, mate. I just travel halfway around the world. So I did him a favour and put it on.
Yeah, well, Hawks are nicely placed.
I'm a Hawks man, very much. Yeah,
nicely
love the
placed.
Hawks.
Right in the mix for the flag again. Maybe their third in a row. We'll wait and see. Stephen, all the best for the next fortnight. Great to reminisce with you.
Good to talk to you. Take care, guys. See ya.
Stephen Huss, who won Wimbledon in 2005. Who's going to win Wimbledon now? Last word, a winner. Come on. One male, one female for the next fortnight. It all starts Monday.
I'm a bandwagon jumper, and I'm going to go on to the Fed man now.
Yep.
Look, I thought Wawrinka was looking good last week, but...
You're telling me that Roger Federer can win another major?
I think he can, because grass... It's not going to be as draining on his body. The matches are not going to go for as long. Look, I think there's a few dark horses in there. I liked Kevin Anderson. I like Burdick's always there about. No, Rainich, Isner, Karlovic.
I can't wait.
Our man, Troike. I mean, I'm going to mention half the draw BP, so I'm probably sitting on the fence. But okay, I'll go with Fed.
You're going with Federer. Okay.
What about you?
Well, I don't think he can win another major, Roger. He was great in Harley, but that's where he's at, I reckon. Three sets, the 500s, the 250s.
He's a force.
He's going to need
sets.
Some luck.
Agreed.
He'd need a couple of big upsets.
He's going to win matches quicker, though.
Djokovic and Nadal or Murray to go out in major upsets. And I can't see that happening. Status quo will prevail and the big four will be there. And girls?
Girls, I'm thinking Serena again.
She's had no practice.
Boring.
Just rocked up.
Boring, but...
At the practice court, she'll have a couple of hits and ready to go on Monday. Thanks, Paul.
Take care, BP.
Nice work.
Thank
we'll
you.
Do it again next Wednesday night, and we'll be talking plenty of tennis right across all programming.